Welcome to another episode of Threads of Enlightenment. You guys know my custom here is to first welcome our guests because I know they're coming with a couple of commodities that are very expensive in my eyes, their time. Every one of us have 24 hours on this planet Earth. What we do with our time, how we respect and honor time will speak volumes of you. The other is the journey. The journey has creative power. Why? Because it created the individual that is before us. And so we want to thank that individual and honor him, Bob, for coming and share both of these quality things, commodities with us, because we are about to learn wisdom, insight, and knowledge to assist us so that we can become better human spirits while we are here on this planet. Bob, thank you so much for coming to Threads of Enlightenment.
It's a pleasure and an honor to be with you, Ken.
Thank you so much, sir. One of the questions, as I said, that my audience are familiar with this is, how do you serve mankind? Because, Bob, I want them to see that this life is not just about them. You have to learn that it's much more than that. And how do you serve mankind?
Let me start to answer that question by telling you what the main question in my life is.
Yes.
And that question is, have I done enough? And that's the question that that plagues me and bolsters me. I also think about Carter, Jimmy Carter's statement.
Yeah.
That my faith calls me to do whatever I can, however I can, whenever I can, and all that I can.
Yeah.
And service is it is the fundamental leg that happiness, purpose, and meaning sit on. So I serve in many ways. I was a lawyer for 40 years. I started out as a mob lawyer in Miami. I didn't start out that way, but I became a mob lawyer in Miami, and kind of arrogant and self-centered, looking for money and power. Then I went through some transformations, and today my legal career ended as a public defender and representing indigent folks, taking care of what the Lord would have called the least of these.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is where I serve. I think that people can be part of the least of these in various ways, and it doesn't mean what their wealth is, and it means what their spirit is. Yeah. There are people that are struggling and that are hurting and that are unhappy because they haven't been introduced to the glory of service. And if I can help them to see that, I'm a meditation teacher. I'm a happiness coach. I teach at Elon University. I try to free those kids up from the trappings of greed. And I see wonderful results. If I can tell you just one story, after serving here in North Carolina as an attorney for some 20 years, and I retired from going to court every day, I received a letter from one of the judges that I used to kind of go head to head with from time to time. And it surprised me because it was a handwritten letter. And in that letter, he said to me, "Thank you for your service." And I had not perceived the work that I was doing as service. And that letter opened my heart, and it brought tears to my eyes. And I realized that in the way that he saw it, my taking care of those people that needed help was providing service. And that was a wonderful gift he gave me.
That is a powerful story, Bob. One of my best friends is a public attorney out in Orlando. A little steps away from where you're at, when you were in Miami. One of our customs, Bob, is to go back. We like to start, and I tell people that I call it that time machine that's called memory. Because the first space that we visit for a short time, Bob, is called the family, where we're there with mom and dad. And right at that position there, mom and dad, they see the world through their perspective based on whatever trauma they may have experienced in their life. And they're beginning to data input stuff into us. And those time with mom and dad and family are formative years, in a sense, where we began to develop our own beliefs and perspective about the outside world. What was your family like?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. Thank you so much for it. So my mom and my dad were Eastern European immigrants. My dad was actually born in 1898. Just to give you a time frame, his family was Hungarian royalty. He met my mother here in the United States. Her family was Roma Gypsy. So you go figure that that match. it turns out that all of my ancestors on both sides of my family had been slaughtered. The Bolsheviks slaughtered my father's family, and everybody slaughtered the Romas. So I really have no ancestors going back to those old countries, but my parents both came to the conclusion that there couldn't possibly be a God that would allow such pain and suffering to exist in their lives. And so I grew up without any kind of religious or spiritual training or education or any belief system in the family. Although my father was a very ethical man, he was a very honest man, he was a very meticulous man, and he was a good man. Although the funny thing was that, as he used to say to me in his kind of Hungarian Dracula-like accent, you must go to the Sunday school, because you must learn the Bible stories. You are an American. You must learn these stories. So he would take me to churches, and I would go into the children's Sunday school and listen to the stories. And quite frankly, to listen to things like Noah's Ark and the like at that time was kind of Disney to me. But there was something that no matter where, and we grew up in a carnival. We were the cotton candy popcorn trailer.
Yeah.
And wherever we went, whatever city we were in, whatever church he brought me to, there was this consistent message that they kept giving me, and that there was this somebody. I wasn't quite sure exactly what he was, but it was this somebody that existed somewhere in the universe, and that he loved me.
Yeah.
He loved me profoundly, and that there was nothing I could do that would shake that love. And, you know, that was something that entered my heart and stayed with me all of my life. And it got me through a lot of the dark periods. But to progress the story, at 15, I read a science fiction story by Isaac Asimov called The Last Question. Mm-hmm. And he spoke about entropy. And he said that entropy, I looked it up, and the physical law of entropy says that things will fall into disorganization unless acted upon by an outside organizing force. So I went to my father and I said to him, well, the universe seems kind of organized, Dad. what do you think the organizing force is behind all that? And he looked at me and shook his head. It goes, silly, silly question. But that started me on my spiritual journey of seeking.
Yeah.
So life goes on, and I grow up. I become a lawyer. I work for Janet Reno.
Bob? What was it that directed you in that direction versus an accountant? A doctor, what was it that sent you towards that direction as a lawyer?
Yeah. So that is a real woo-wee story. So I had a football scholarship to Boston University, broke my ankle, flunked out, was going to another school to take restaurant management because we were the cotton candy trailer. I became a hippie, You know, we're talking 1968, 1969, 1970. And we had a hippie pad, and there was this fellow named John Berman. And we would always get into these arguments about the Vietnamese War and Cambodia and Nixon and the like. And he, John's job was to read the New York Times and the Washington Post and be our library.
Yeah.
And he kept telling me I should be a lawyer. And I used to be a lawyer. And I go, oh, stop. All I want to do is sell hot dogs on the boardwalk in the summer and do nothing in the winter.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, John disappeared for about 2 weeks. And then he came back and he had an envelope. And in the envelope was a postal money order to the Educational Testing Service for $356, which was the entrance fee to take the law school aptitude test.
Wow.
Where'd you get the money, John? I got a job. Oh, you're working. He says, no, I quit. I just wanted to earn enough money so you could go take this test.
Wow.
So how could you say no? I couldn't say no to that. So I took the test and some law school accepted me. And that's how I became a lawyer.
Wow, that's a great story, man. That is something that is not a common story that someone saw that in you, that stepped out to that degree and came back in to offer you something that they felt you should go through, not you. That's interesting story.
And the kicker to the story is that John was a heroin addict, and we had pulled him out of shooting galleries two or three times. And when I was accepted to law school, he stopped using, came down to Miami with me and got a job. And he went to community college to become a paralegal. And I was going to be Perry Mason and he was going to be my investigator. 3 days after I was sworn in as a lawyer, John overdosed and died. He stayed with me from the moment I got into law school all the way through till I was sworn in. And it was almost as if he had completed his mission, his assignment. It is almost as if he had completed his assignment and he checked out.
Let me ask you a question, Bob, because he's a pivotal piece in your life. At least in the beginning, how did you handle that?
His when he out, leaving,
if you will.
I think you had to know John. Several friends from New York came down for the funeral. It was closed. It was several days before he was found, so it was closed casket. And we went out to the grave, all of us. Three, four of us of the old gang. And when they lowered the casket into the ground, it was the sun clouded over and the wind kicked up. And a piece of tumbleweed bounced by. And then the sun cleared up and the wind went. And we all looked at each other and go, wow, man, you know, goodbye, John. And then we all went out and we had a party and we had a few drinks and we laughed about all of John's craziness because we knew that John would not like us to be sad.
So it was you guys celebrated, in other words.
We celebrated
his life. Yeah, that is awesome, man. So after you did your celebration now, Bob, and you're looking at the next 5 years of your life, you're looking at your life, you're now a lawyer. This gift was offered. What did you find yourself doing with that offering, if you will, of a lawyer? And how, because you mentioned that you represented a lot of the gangsters and mob and back in it. How did that progression happen? This young man, and he's in Miami. And he is moving through and he becomes that type of lawyer of representation of those folks.
So we were allowed to work in our third year for a public service. And I chose the district attorney's office And by the time I graduated law school, I already had two jury trials under my belt. And I guess John was right. I was pretty good at what I did. And after about 5 years, joined the state's attorney's office and the feds formed a federal task force. We hit the mob up for $72 million. And shortly thereafter, I just hung my shingle out. I left the office and hung my shingle out. And I'll call on Johnny, came to visit me within 2 weeks. Basically, he said, you know, you got to be pretty good to get that much out of us. Is it okay if I start sending you? I want to send you some clients. So I want to clarify, I was never consigliere, I just received, you know, some referrals. He would send me a lot of clients. And I did very well. I had even paid my house off by the time I was 32. And we had a very clear relationship because it was in his best interest to have an honorable lawyer that was respected by the courts. So I would not do anything that was illegal or unethical. And we all agreed that was in everybody's best interest.
Yeah.
Sub 1988, his son got arrested. And then there was no saying no to him. He wanted me to do certain things, which I couldn't do. So I was driving north and had passed through North Carolina in the springtime and the azaleas were out and the dogwoods were flowering and I thought I would move there. So I went back and said to Johnny, I think I'm going to move to North Carolina. And he goes, well, Bob, that way we can part friends. Sometimes a man just has to move on. So I moved to North Carolina and went back to be in a, but the important thing that that I think for us now is that while I was with Johnny and during the early 80s, I was going out to a lot of chrome and glass bars with them, was doing things I ought not have been doing. My family life was going down the tubes. I was getting hooked up with a lot of arrogance. I was bottoming out, even though I was still functioning and I was still, you know, able to go to court and the like. My personal life was just falling apart. So I was seeing a therapist. And here is the big crux and change in my life.
Yeah.
So one day I decided I had decided I wanted to go into this business. It was going to make me $1 million. It was going to, you know, millions. I went into this business and it came down to a point where it was because I was floundering. It was floundering. Everything was floundering. And I would have to remortgage my house in order to keep it going. And I asked my therapist, George, should I do it? And George turns around and he grabs a bag and he takes out 3 coins and he shakes the coins, he drops them and he does some mathematical calculations. He draws a line, keeps doing this. And then he reaches behind him. He writes down the number 42, opens the chapter to 42, shows me the title of the chapter and it says retreat. So I promptly curse him out. Because I'm paying him $65 an hour to throw coins. Come on. Right? And I stomp out. But it was absolutely the right advice. And so instead of mortgaging the house, I closed the business. And I went back a couple of weeks later. I said, George, what was that? And he goes, well, that was the I Ching.
The I Ching, yeah. Uh-huh.
And I said, I say, what's the I Ching? And I proceed to find out that George is the English language editor for Master Watching Me, a 72nd generation master from the Shaolin Temple, Taoist.
Wow.
So I say, well, what's Taoism? And so Master Ni comes to Miami the next week. So I sit with Master Ni, and I could feel my heart opening up.
Yeah,
I could feel his energy, even though he was a quiet, smiling, happy, probably the happiest human being I'd ever met in my life. And so I studied with Master Ni and George for 8 years before I came to Miami, before I came to North Carolina. And that was the transformational moment in my life.
Man, Bob, that is a powerful being that you got a chance to meet. I remember I studied the I Ching and stuff like that, and reading the Vedas, the old books, even way before books and stuff before the Bible was even printed or even came to being. And it's amazing what's in there. Those principles are all over humanity in every single culture that is named on this planet. And it's really fascinating to watch. And that's a powerful experience that you had. So here you are, Bob, sitting under that power. And what were some of the things that you started to notice in you hanging around these guys and having those conversations? I know that he is going to be introducing you to meditation and all those type tools, bringing in your space. As you are lingering there for several years, you said, what did you begin to notice about Bob?
One time we asked Master Ni, we asked him, what's it like to be you? What's it like to be a master? And he quickly answered, as he always did, totally responsive. No rehearsing thoughts. We had to think about that for a little bit, but then we realized that this man had arrived at a point in life where everything he did was like muscle memory. It was like an athlete who's in the zone and feels like it's not even him that's doing anything. That was how he lived life. So, you know, engaging in the practices, especially the practice of the I Ching on a daily basis, began to teach me how to, you know, everybody wants to go with the flow.
Yeah.
Everybody, that idea, you know, going down an inner tube on a nice, sweet, you know, little creek, la-di-da-di-da. But going with the flow is much more profound than that. First, you have to recognize what the flow is, and then you have to have the wisdom to align yourself with that flow. Because sometimes the flow is conflictual. Sometimes it promotes what you want to do. Sometimes it restrains it. Sometimes it's a time of... So the I Ching teaches you the energies that are around. Like sometimes it's a time to advance and sometimes a time to retreat. And how is the most effective and efficient way to act in those times? So I started to notice as I practiced and I studied with Ni the I Ching, I began to be able to notice the energy that was around. So if nobody was listening to me, I learned to shut up.
Basically.
And when people really were interested in what I had to say, you know, I brought everything that I had to the table. And so I started to do that, and slowly I began to sense and feel what being responsive in life and going with the flow felt like. And that inspired me and motivated me to really take on meditation as a constant practice and move forward.
Yeah, meditation saved my life, Bob. I was in the midst of corporate America like everyone else, rising up, going up the ladder, chasing the power and the money and the all the things that they tell us that that's what we ought to chase, because they say when you get those things, you're going to be happy. You know what I mean? And we know that that's an illusion, because things never make one happy. You know, things are just some things, you know, but the lasting effect of the internal compass that we have, things have nothing to do with it. And so it saved my life. So here you are, you incorporated meditation in your life and it became your practice. As you're now moving through your life, you're bringing all these tools and you're heading out in your personal development, if you will, the terminology that they use, and you're learning more about you, Bob. What did you begin to aspire to do from out of you? You know, it comes where you see that you are, it's more than something, because I tell people there's this unrest that sits inside your chest that refuses to move. And it is pushing you forward, and it's kind of pulling you to come and come. When those things began to sit in your chest, Bob, what did you begin to notice it was taking you to, and how did you resist, and when did you learn to surrender to the flow, if you will?
So I think that would have been 1999. So I am still doing criminal work, but I'm doing it as an appointed attorney, taking care of indigent people. I'm noticing that they are going through a revolving door.
Yeah.
And it hurts me that I spend some time, get to know somebody, even if they've made a mistake in their life, and even if, you know, they're charged with a crime, and they would go off and do their penance, and then I would see them again and again. And that hurt me. And I said, there's something that I'm not providing here. I guess what you talk about, that thing that was sitting in my chest, is wanting to make a difference in the lives of these people who came before me.
Yeah.
You know? So I closed my practice in 99. I shut down and I went back to school and I got a master's in social work to be able to more holistically understand the psychological aspects, therapeutic aspects of what it means to be a human being.
Yeah.
And went out, I did some addiction counseling till I got a handle on the skill, and then went back to taking care of these folks. And I approached it with a completely different state of mind. Rather than being focused on what the result is for their court case, my focus was, whatever may happen to this person, whatever consequences may result in their life, let them leave my presence feeling that they've been heard, feeling that someone loved them. And even if they're not happy with the results, let them understand the fairness, the equity, if there is any, or this, how the system works and why they wound up getting the consequence they got. And if they can leave with that, having been heard and loved, then maybe they're not going to keep that narrative against the system and that internal victimization. Maybe that wouldn't keep gnawing at them. And maybe when they finished this particular bout, they wouldn't come back. And it's only anecdotal. I can't tell you, you know, from statistics, but my sense of it is that fewer of them came back after that.
Well, that's some serious statistics, Bob. You know, because if you... Yeah, you stated before that there was this revolving door, and even if it's a few, those are some,
even if it's a few,
that's a damn good statistic. I would say. And when you saw that, because again, I'm sure you incorporated a lot of the mindset that you gain from your years studying the I Ching and being in those powerful presence of those men. I'm sure you're bringing in that mindset piece, you're bringing in the psychological piece from the studies of educational piece. As you begin to merge them, synchronize these two, perception dealing with the human condition, what did you begin to notice? You said there was a few, it slowed down the door, if you will. What did you see happen to cause that slowing down from the folks? What was the language? What was the conversation with them after that?
I don't know that I had many conversations with the same people, but you know, I have learned very profoundly that that being heard is just so important.
Yeah,
it's just so important. A little funny ditty with my wife once. She kept telling me things, and I had to stop her at one point and said to her, "Hey, honey, look, is it more important to you to say what you want to say the way that you want to say it, or is it more important to you that I understand what you're trying to tell me?" Hmm. Well, of course, it's more important that you understand what I'm trying to tell you. So I said,
"Of course, Bob. I don't know why you asked that question."
Of course. So I said, "Well, you're going to have to tell me a different way because I'm not getting it, you know?" And if we're going to be compassionate, empathic people, we have to get a feel of what's going on over there, so that we can talk into the listening and at the pace and with the level of language that, you know, is heard. And then we have to sit back and listen to folks.
Yeah.
If I could, just one little story. I had a client who came over in the Mariel boat lift when I was still in Miami. And he was a political prisoner under Castro and was forced put onto a fishing boat and came back to Miami. Anyway, when he got here, he went out and he committed several armed robberies. I came to represent him. And he was looking at several life sentences, and I worked out a plea for 12 years. And he would not even listen to me. But he says, "I'm not going to make any deals with the government. I'm not going to do that. The government is terrible. I won't agree to anything with them."
Yeah.
And, the 12-year-old deal, as opposed to two or three life sentences, was a very good deal for him. The evidence was overwhelming. And so I said to him, "Okay, all right, I get it. The government sucks. So I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to go out there and we're going to tell the government to go take a hike. And we're just going to tell them that they suck and that they take a hike, and we're not going to make any deals with them. And we're just going to throw ourselves on the mercy of the court."
Yeah.
He goes, "That's fine. Let's do it." Now, I happen to know who the judge was.
Yeah.
And so when I went out there and I said, "Judge, we're not taking any deals from those guys over there, that prosecutor. We're not going to take any deals from them. We're not going to throw it back in their face and da 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 da. They offered us 12 years and da 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 da, and we're not taking it." So the judge got the hint of what was going on. So he leaned over and he said, "Well, I'm going to pass sentence now, and I'm going to give this fellow 12 years and blah, blah, blah." Well, that guy walked out and went off to jail with his head held high. He was happy as a poop. And, you know, so he was heard.
Yeah.
And he was heard. Somebody listened to him and heard him and stood up for him. And, that's, I think, one of the greatest, most inspiring acts of being a lawyer is that over and over and over again, you get to stand for somebody or stand for a cause. It might not be your cause, it might not be you, but you get to stand for something. And usually it's a person. And that is just a spiritually inspiring moment.
Yeah.
You know, to put everything that you have. Yeah.
So here you are, Bob. I mean, you're working with folks that can't really, we label them the indigent and so forth, the less than, those that, as we said on the onset, working with those, that they, you know, when Jesus made the statements about the type of people, here you are. You're working with these people. You're finished, your day is done. You had several cases, you're home. What was happening to Bob?
So in 2015, I had a heart event. It slowed me down for a bit. And I said, maybe this is 2015, I'm 65 years old. And I said, maybe I've had enough. Maybe this is time to retire. So I did. And within 2 months, Elon University comes along and says, will you come and teach our undergraduates business law? So when I got there, I found that they had a whole spiritual center. So my head was more attracted to the spiritual center than it was to teaching business law. So I hung out a lot over there and kept asking about meditation. And so we formed a student meditation group and started doing some other things. And even though I was teaching business law in the business school, you know, I was on campus with meditation and the like. And so finally, I formed an employee a resource group for the faculty and staff. And now I'm the mindfulness coordinator for the university. And it was my intention to try to create a culture of mindfulness in the university. Yeah. And it's making a difference. It's beginning to grow. And, you know, because college students and so many people are so stressed out today.
Yeah.
So these are my new people.
I'm glad, man. Folks. I'm glad, Bob, because that's necessary, because you have 4+ years of data stored there as far as, I always tell people there's the lab and there's the theory, if you will. You have theory in you 4 years plus. No one incorporates the lab. And to me, when it comes to education, mindset training is the lab, Bob. A lot of kids have the theory, but they don't have the lab. And when they get out there, they falter, they're all over the place, and they don't have the mindset that is necessary to move them through being all over the place. And they become something else. So I take my hat off to you for having that and for the university to make that available to the kids, because I think that is probably much more important than just the theory, because if you don't know how to apply the stuff as far as the mind, because that's the playground, Bob, you know, and for you to be able to witness some of that, talk to us about some of that, because you get a chance, I'm sure you do, get a chance to see some of the kids that are coming in, and they're all over, and when they began to sit and began to get under the power of meditation. And I tell people meditation is about teaching you how to control your thoughts and becoming one that can choose which thought you want to go to progress forward versus having all of this stuff coming at you. So talk to me as you began to teach them how to turn the knob a little slower to fine tune the thoughts, and what did you witness with these kids as they began to apply the information that you brought to them?
Yeah. So, when I give them the certificate at the end of the course, the big seal in the middle says, "You are not your thoughts."
Yeah. That's it. It's powerful.
And to watch them move from being their thoughts and having no access to what thoughts they have, to help them discover and explore this this observer state of mind, where you can actually watch your thoughts and eventually learn how to organize your thoughts. And it gives you the same peace of mind as kind of organizing a messy desk.
Yeah.
You know, you might have like all kinds of stuff all over your desk, and you may spend some time, and it's very stressful, but then you spend a little time just organizing it and putting in files and sorting it out. You may not have completed any task, but you are much more de-stressed.
Yeah.
Because it's all in order. And that's kind of the process, you know, as once they get the basic skills, you start labeling thoughts and labeling feelings and organizing it. And you start to see them have access to their thinking and also to deconstruct their emotions into nothing more than a thought and a body sensation, so that they're not driven by it. They can choose, certainly, to be angry. They can choose, you know, to be sad. But like the Irish say, I love the Irish expression, they don't say I'm sad, they say sadness is upon me.
That's how a lot of the old, the ancient people would speak in, you know, as far as stuff, because I remember some of that in my culture from West Indies. My dad and my mom and my grandmother would say, sadness has come upon me, or sickness has come upon me. And stuff like that.
It's a recognition that it's a passing thing that's here now and may not be here later. Whereas before, they were so stuck in it. If I'm sad now, I'm always going to be sad.
Yeah.
If I'm angry, you know. So it's very wonderful to see them break those chains. So there's one other little piece that I'd like to share, if I may.
So
with my Taoist background, there's not a lot of Taoists in North Carolina, so I started attending Buddhists. Temples. And I finally met my second wife, and she is a bodhisattva. She is a saint, but she is also she was a Southern Baptist Bible literalist. Who believes in the Bible literally, that all the stories of the Bible are historical to her. So one day she's about to leave for church, and I'm just, you know, going to stay home and watch the news stories on Sunday morning. And she says, she has these sad, sad eyes. And I said, you know, honey, what's wrong? She goes, well, you know, I love you so much, and I just hate it that you're not going to go to heaven with me. and I said to her, well, I hate it that you're not going to be reincarnated with me. And she goes, oh, stop. And she slapped me, you know. But then I decided that we need to have a Rosetta Stone, because the teachings of Jesus and the writings of Lao Tzu, they don't have a hair's breadth of difference between us. It's about service. It's about humility. It's about understanding, you know, your place. It's about washing your feet. It's about washing the feet of those who you love. It's about care. It's about appropriateness. It's about all of these same things. And so I started taking the Tao Te Ching, which is the seminal book of Taoism. It's 81 meditations, or 80, we call them chapters. 81 chapters, and I started taking couplets and imagining them into Christian language. As an example, you know, Lao Tzu says that the good leader does their work and then steps down so that their work can endure. Yeah. And she would go, I don't get that. And I said, well, look what Jesus did. Jesus did his work and then he ascended. And look how his work has endured. Oh, I get it. And so I started translating imagining. Finally, I wound up doing all 81 chapters.
Wow.
And Kendall Hunt picked it up, and they've just recently published it.
Nice.
And so this is a Christian devotional based on the Tao Te Ching.
Wow. And guys, you guys will see it. It's I Am the Way. And we're going to provide the link and everything for you guys to get access to Bob's information, because that's important. I'm from a Christian background, studied Taoism, studied Buddhism. And as I said earlier in the conversation, the Vedas, those books, the I Ching, those books are older than the Bible, several thousand years before the Bible was even, Jesus was on the scene. And the principles Bob and I are talking about, the principles are universal. And, you know, they're universal. It's just how we speak about it and the language that we use. And what Bob did was took the language that is in from a totally different belief system and kind of bring it and show you with the spirit, with the Christianity piece of it. It's the same thing, guys. Don't allow differences in culture to cause you to go to war with each other.
would you like necessary. Me to read a chapter?
Oh, please, please.
So pick a number at random from 1 to 81. We'll do it that way.
I'll take 42. 42. I have the book, by the way, Bob. I read that book myself as well. I love his writings, and I have a library of his.
Okay, so the way that I organize the book, each chapter has a title and a quote from someone, and then my writing. So chapter 42, the title is, In the Beginning There Was Only God. And it reads, In the beginning there was only God. God created man, and from man made woman. And woman gave birth to man. Thus, man resides in woman, and woman resides in man. God created the energy we call male. God created the energy we call female. He imbued man with the masculine energy and the feminine energy, so that man could understand women. He imbued women with the feminine energy and the masculine energy, so that women could understand man. It was a combination of these energies that populated the world and filled it with the 10,000 things. The masculine energy accomplishes, the feminine energy nurtures. Too much masculine leads to war. Too much feminine leads to la la kumbaya. Balancing these energies leads to the great harmony. When harmony is lost, the people become lonely as orphans and widows and believe themselves to be unworthy. Those who lead with harmony and balance understand their importance. We hear them say, it happened through me, not by me. They are quick to give others credit. Put all this aside. The most essential teaching is this. Those who live a violent life shall not enjoy a natural death.
Wow, that is well said, Bob, well said. I love it. Guys, those of you, again, that are listening, we're going to provide the information for you guys to get access to Bob. And one of his gift, if you will, his assignment is to bring information to you about mindset training. And he incorporates it a different way. And so we have this program of Threads of Enlightenment to bring all these different type people together so that those that you are, and I always tell people, Bob, the ones that are listening, learn to become hearers, because the hearers are the one that will change their life. Listeners will just run off wherever, mm-hmm. but a hearer is destined to change their life, because what they will do is begin to take the steps necessary to make that thing that they heard inside their inner man or their subconscious to become a reality. We're going to provide all of Bob's information for you guys to get in there.
Thank you.
And that you will learn from him so that you can change your reality. Bob, this has been a good one, man. I told you I was going to try and pull all, as much as I can.
You did.
Out of you.
You got it all.
You know, and let me close it out with this, Bob, because I feel this once in a while with a few people, and then I always ask. You remember back in the day when you had that thing sitting in your chest that was pulling you?
Mm-hmm.
What is it that you sense within yourself now in today's world that you feel a sense of like pulling you, just beginning to, it's just there, just a little tapping on you going, yeah, I need to expand you a little more. What is it, Bob, that you're beginning to feel within yourself?
So I'm still pretty involved in a lot of stuff, but I get up early in the morning and I like to write. And lately, I have begun writing letters. Something passes across my consciousness that grabs my attention, like somebody that is feeling unworthy.
Yeah.
And so I'll sit down and I write a letter to my my friend who's feeling unworthy.
Yeah.
And I'll write that letter, and you know, all of that experience of 74 years and all of the quotes and stories that I've heard and that I've experienced and everything else comes out of me about, you know, things would come out like about our uniqueness. And again, I love that expression, that old Jewish expression that says the day that you were born was the day that God decided the world could not exist without you.
Wow.
And so using that as a theme, I'll write the letter. And so that's what has my passion right now. I mean, I'm still teaching meditation and have my private classes and teach at the university, but that's really what's got my passion now. And I'm hoping that I could put together a collection of such letters. You know, at my age, you start thinking about things like legacy.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I want to put that wisdom down on paper somewhere. So I Neil Diamond, I saw his Broadway play, and, you know, his music is his legacy.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful play. I loved it. But, you know, we all look at what is it that we're going to leave behind. And so this, I'm kind of feeling that.
That is awesome, man. And I'm going to stay in touch with you, Bob. So when you put those things together, whether it's a book form or blog or however you put it out, we want to make sure that it's brought to the attention of the folks here at Threads of Enlightenment on the platform as well as YouTube, so that they'll make them aware of it, so that they can have access to that information that you provide. So we'll stay in touch. Bob, I want to thank you so much for coming to Threads of Enlightenment. This has been a good one, sir.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to be with you and to be on your podcast.
Thank you, sir.
A real pleasure.
Thank you.